This episode is brought to you in part by Thomas Nelson, publisher of I Want to Matter, Your Life is Too Short and Too Precious to Waste. Written and narrated by New York Times bestseller Kathy Lee Gifford. Available now everywhere you get audiobooks.
Today we're going to talk about A Lesson Before Dying, Ernest Gaines' great novel, which unfortunately not enough of my friends know about this amazing book. I actually first approached Gaines through A Gathering of Old Men, which I loved and was a very moving novel. And then when I started reflecting on how to die well for The Scandal of Holiness, I picked up this novel. So it was kind of, this was my first read. I've only read it once now. And so I invited Jack Heller from Huntington University because he knows the novel better than I do, so that I can ask him questions and talk about this book and why it is that he loves it. So Jack, thanks for spending this time talking about it.
All right, it's my pleasure.
I appreciate it. Would you mind introducing yourself to people in case they don't know you or aren't familiar with you?
My name is Jack Heller. I'm a professor of English at Huntington University in Huntington, Indiana. This is my 20th year here. And I teach in the areas of Shakespeare, Renaissance drama, and American literature, primarily African-American literature. So these are some of my areas of interest. And as a sideline, I'm also a prison volunteer. So.
Oh, fantastic. Oh, that's wonderful. That gives you even more experience, of course, being able to talk about the novel. Do you mind talking about how you came to this novel? What was your first experience with it?
I also first read A Gathering of Old Men.
Okay.
This would have been probably in the late 1980s. And A Lesson Before Dying came out in 1993. And around that time, I was a graduate student at Louisiana State University. And around that time, Ernest Gaines came and did a reading from A Lesson Before Dying.
Wow.
And I suspect that that's around the time I bought the novel. It's so long ago that I don't really remember when did I exactly first read it.
Yeah.
But I heard him do a reading of at least the first two chapters. And thereafter, at some point, I read it. And then I first started teaching it probably around 2002.
Wow. So did you get to meet Gaines during that visit?
I've met Gaines several times.
Oh, my gosh. I didn't know that.
Well, informally. I mean, I can't say that we were buddies by any means, but we, I heard him do that presentation. In 2016, I participated in a National Endowment for the Humanities program studying his work and met him again then, even had been to his home.
Wow.
Gave him a bottle of Four Roses bourbon. In 2017, even shared a bottle.
Oh,
I think it was Maker's Mark with him.
Yeah.
Not too much with him, but I had interesting, the few times I was able to talk with him, it was very interesting to engage with him. And so I've had that privilege several times. Unfortunately, he's no longer with us, but
right.
One thing I was able to do, which appears in some of his writings, is attend one of the cemetery cleanings that he talks about. That cemetery that appears in A Gathering of Old Men is behind where his home was located.
Uh-huh.
And he talks about the cemetery cleanings in his Mozart and Leadbelly.
Oh.
Along with this, with A Lesson Before Dying. So,
yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's fantastic. I mean, I know I do want to talk about A Lesson Before Dying, but I want to know a little bit more about Gaines, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
I mean, what was his demeanor like? I you know, I've met lots of writers, and they kind of vary across the map whether they're more reserved or they're more open.
I would say he was genteel, quite willing to engage with people. You know, when we had a reception, he was not off in the corner. He was very much willing to talk with the folks who were there. really could throw a good spread. I mean, the time that I attended that cemetery cleaning, he fed everybody who did that. Gumbo, all the stuff that you see as food in A Lesson Before Dying was food when he and his wife hosted people.
Yeah.
His wife is the person that A Lesson Before Dying was dedicated to. So had that opportunity. Always a great person to talk with, I think.
But yeah.
Again, I don't want to overclaim.
Right, right, yeah.
Buddies, but
yeah, yeah.
But I had this privilege several times of meeting him.
Oh, that's great. And did he talk about his work at all? Were you able? I mean, you've read a lot on his work, so you probably know how he thought about his own work.
He did. The time that I met him with the NEH participants, a lot of that was a Q&A opportunity.
Hmm.
And we were all over the place in the conversations there.
Yeah.
But I'm sure that I asked something. I wouldn't have let that pass, but I don't remember what it was.
Oh, that's great. So tell me about A Lesson Before Dying, especially for people who aren't aware of the story. So what is, you know, in my book, I only go into really what is this transformation that happens for Jefferson. But do you mind giving some background about the story and why it was written?
The story was begun in the 1980s and completed, I think, late in the 80s and published in 1993. And it was his follow-up to A Gathering of Old Men. What it's about essentially is that there are two men. One has been falsely accused of robbery and murder, but he was convicted, as could be anticipated in the 1940s in Louisiana. Mm-hmm. He was sentenced to be executed. This would be Jefferson.
Mm-hmm.
He's tried, he's convicted, he's sentenced. His godmother afterwards approaches another young man in the same community and says, tells him that she wants him to go to the jail and help this young man understand the value of his own life, help him to understand what it means, what it means to be a man, what the value of his life should have been, not that he didn't value his own life, but what it was that the culture was missing in the value of his life.
Mm-hmm.
And what we come to find out along the way is that both of these men really don't see it themselves. They don't see themselves as having that value.
Mm-hmm.
So A Lesson Before Dying in some ways is a lesson of who the individual is, what is that person's worth, how do we measure a person's worth, how do we prepare ourselves for our own ends? A Lesson Before Dying. Jefferson gets a lesson before dying that his was a life that had value. His value was not appreciated, but it had value. He learns this. He learns that he is capable of acts of love. He doesn't really know that, but he's capable of it. So he learns that. At the same time, while this teacher is visiting him, he has to learn this too. Mm-hmm. And I would say that there are two characters that get lessons before dying.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them has some years ahead of him to still apply it. So,
Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah, maybe it should have been called Lessons Before Dying instead of A Lesson Before Dying. Because even, you know, the Reverend seems to have learned some. I mean, the way that Gaines approaches almost the whole town, when you think about it, at the very end of the story, there's so many people that have learned some lessons before dying.
I would say that the Reverend, I mean, he's a very interesting character. And Gaines talks about him in contrast to a preacher character in A Gathering of Old Men.
Hmm.
Gaines, in one of his interviews, indicates that he got letters from African-American readers responding to a gathering of old men and asked him, why did he make that preacher in that novel such a dope? Essentially. Wow, he was very conscious of making Reverend Ambrose not a dope. Not to say that he doesn't have some problems himself, particularly in relation to the radio that appears in the novel. But he has something that even Grant doesn't have. He recognizes, I think, before Grant does, the value of Jefferson's life, although he thinks that value is only a spiritual value. And I think that's something that he needs to learn, that it's not just that. But at the same time, I think he recognizes Jefferson's not, this is the word used in the novel, not a hog, before Grant and Jefferson themselves recognize that. So,
I have a friend who wrote this book called You Are Not Your Own. And in it, it's Alan Noble. And in it, he talks about how your identity, you can profess your identity as one thing, but if the culture doesn't then recognize that identity, what value does that identity have? And it seems like that's a lot of what this novel is also addressing, is that our identity is not just a matter of our own self-assertion. It also has to be something that's recognized in the community that we're a part of, right?
And I think, as it turns out, it's mostly the older members of the community who recognize that. Reverend Ambrose, Miss Emma, that's Jefferson's godmother, Tanta Lou, that's Grant's aunt. Vivian also, I think, recognizes that. Vivian, since we're introducing the novel, Grant's girlfriend, all right. But Grant doesn't really understand it. Jefferson doesn't understand it. And certainly the dominant white community won't even give the thought any consideration at all. So all of this has to happen within the Black community in this fictional area that Gaines has created. And
Do you think that happens then by the end? I mean, do you think that, I'm also wondering, I mean, why does it have to take place in this way, which I love, and I have my own thoughts on it, but I'm interested to hear yours. Why does it have to take place looking at it in terms of death, looking at it where you have a deadline in a sense for a person, you know, when his death is coming, it has a date, it has a time. Why do we need that stamp on the narrative in order for these questions to be raised?
Gaines addresses that in an interesting way in his essay about writing the novel. He did actually think about, did he want to do a governor's pardon? And I'm so glad he didn't. Now, of course, the novel would have had a happier ending if he had. But I think in some ways, true to his work across his novels, all through his novels, the Black characters in Gaines's novels are living without access to justice. When we think about the history of Black America, you know, there's a certain sense that we always, I mean, I've been to a lot of museums of African-American history. Sometimes, depending on who's running the museum, there's almost a kind of all that was the past, but it's all progressing right now. It's all becoming better right now. And I don't know that in 1830 anybody would have seen this. I mean, if you were enslaved, what was going to be the end of one's life? Your life might always, for its entirety, be that. So I think what Gaines is looking at in some ways is, how do we live when there is no assurance of justice? When there is no cultural understanding of one's value, when the oppressiveness of the context just closes off possibility. I think he was right. Gaines also considered setting this as contemporary to the time he was writing this. And then he moved it back to the 1940s. And I think that was important to the story he wrote, because you could not, from the context of this novel, anticipate the civil rights movement, the changes in law. Mm-hmm. How do you live when oppression is your context? Mm-hmm. And I think in some ways, I don't know if this is one of the novels that you address in your text, although it wouldn't surprise me. I think in some ways, you know, we're looking at circumstances that might even be sort of parallel to, say, Endo's Silence or something like that, where you can't really force upon this a happy ending. Mm-hmm. Without that possibility, now what? What do we do when we can't have that?
This podcast is sponsored by Brasses Press. Brasses Press publishes books that creatively draw upon the riches of the Christian story to deepen our understanding of God's world and inspire faithful reflection and engagement. A Brasses Press book that I recommend is How to Inhabit Time, Understanding the Past, Facing the Future, Living Faithfully Now by James K.A. Smith. In the book, Smith helps Christians and the church develop a sense of temporal awareness that is attuned to the texture of history, the vicissitudes of life, and the tempo of the spirit. Smith shows that awakening to the spiritual significance of time is crucial for orienting faith in the 21st century. Get 40% off and free shipping at bakerbookhouse.com with code READING.
Yeah, I think it's such an interesting question with him setting it in the 1940s, because there's always this question about the role that literature plays in cultural, you know, the cultural memory, mm-hmm. right? And so here, it's not like Elie Wiesel's Night written actually in the 1940s, where Wiesel says, never shall I forget, never shall I forget. But there's this insistence upon not forgetting the tragedies of our past. In some ways, being able to draw on the past and the tragedies of the past, we're able to re-see the tragedies of our current time in a way that if you have a novel set in our current time, people assume a certain political angle, there becomes tribalism, people don't want to read it, but going backwards kind of frees you from that, because you know, you're not in the 1940s anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I understand that, although going back to my sort of introductory comment here, The novel had something to do with my sort of thinking about, well, after all, do I want to be involved in working in prisons? Yeah. And I did not teach, but I helped to get a group started within a prison reading this novel. And there was a lot of interesting response to this novel read in that context. Now, many of the men that would have read it in that context would have been, I think, sort of properly adjudicated. Not all of them. I mean, mm-hmm. there's some wrongful convictions within where I volunteer, but there are also those that it was very, I mean, they would say so themselves. Why contradict it? But for all of that, the understanding, I think, that they can themselves sort of work through, yes, there's a value here. Regardless, there's a value here. Humanity has its own value. We don't need to find something else, somewhere else to say, okay, that's the value. Jefferson, uneducated, unemployed or underemployed, he thinks of himself as a hog. Mm-hmm. That word really has that tremendous effect on him, and he needs to find a way to get through that. Beyond that, part of what humanizes Jefferson isn't so much what does he learn about himself, but he learns, well, okay, let me rephrase that. He learns something about himself, but it's an unexpected lesson. What he learns is he's capable of loving somebody. Mm-hmm. And it's not a romantic love, it's loving his godmother.
Yeah.
You know, learning to appreciate what she's trying to do for him. And I would add, to some degree, within the context of friendship, loving Grant.
Yeah, yeah.
Responding to him as well. So that I think that's a lot of how this works out.
This episode is brought to you in part by Pittsburgh Theological Seminary. Pittsburgh Theological Seminary students are grounded in faith and formed in community. PTS students are preparing for ministry with Master of Divinity, Master of Arts, Doctor of Ministry, and certificate programs. Begin your master's or certificate program in person or online. Financial aid is available. Visit pts.edu/admit.
Well, I want to ask you two questions now, and they're completely different because you use it two different things. One, I would love to hear more about what prisoners' responses are to a lesson before dying. And that's going to be a completely different question than the second one I want to ask you, but I'll go ahead and ask it so I don't forget. In the novel, also you have Jefferson coming to terms with, I'm taking my Nanon's cross, I'm taking your cross. That's a lot to ask, right? So he's transforming his imagination of his situation, it seems like, right? And how does that play a role in his move from seeing himself as a hog to seeing himself differently? So those are kind of my two big questions.
Well, let's see. The first one there was about prisoners.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. I think they've responded very well to it. One of the things I recall, particularly when I was talking with one of the men that had read it, was his sense of how that novel sort of defines masculinity in some ways. Mm. Being a man in a lesson before dying is to learn to love, to appreciate. And I think that gentleman that I was speaking with really picked up on that, on that novel.
There is a strength in Jefferson that he discovers that has nothing to do with enforcing power on other people. Mm-hmm. It's an inner strength that allows him to love. I think that your student, you know, was picking up on prisoner. I don't know. I don't want to refer to somebody by just one word now.
Sure.
but you know what he's picking up on there, I think is accurate to what Jefferson discovers, what it means to be a human being. The second question was about how Jefferson's imagination of what he's going through transforms. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, he starts very self-pitying in the opening. I mean, it's almost like he's narrowly confining himself even further than his situation is confined because of the way he's seeing himself. And then it starts to open up to other people in a different way towards the end of the novel.
One of the things that I've struggled with this novel is trying to think through, okay, what is Gaines trying to show us with the last bits of what Jefferson communicates to us? Because we get it through Grant to some degree, not just from Jefferson. It's the very last person's thoughts we have were back to Grant. And Grant has this moment where he says something like he thinks that God was with Jefferson, that somehow or other Jefferson may have had a Christian or spiritual conversion. I'm inconclusive on that. I don't think it's a yes or a no on that. But to some degree, within the diary section of the novel, there is a kind of a framing that goes on there. Jefferson does recognize that his situation has some parallel to the situation of Christ coming to his end. Jefferson says that he will walk as Christ walked. He will withstand as Christ withstood. To that degree, certainly there's a transformation of his character. I don't think that Gaines doesn't show that to us as affirming doctrines, you know, but it's more of a kind of an identification that seems, you know, this is Christ as his sort of a forerunner. He will do as had been done. He will learn that. it's interesting, you know, for those who haven't read the novel, mm-hmm. Gaines does give a kind of a framing on the liturgical calendar. Christmas is an important segment of the novel, and also this execution 2 weeks after Easter, but you'll never forget that it's 2 weeks after Easter.
Right.
You read this novel.
I'm actually glad you highlighted it, because that is not something I paid attention to when I read it. I wasn't thinking, which for me is kind of crazy too, because Walker Percy always frames his novels that way, with, you know, mm-hmm. Christmas or July 4th or Mardi Gras. He's always framing according to the liturgical year. Mm-hmm. But I wasn't registering that. So I'm so glad that you highlighted it. Now I want to go back and read it a second time and see mm-hmm. how that timeline works. But it, you know, historically, of course, that's also a trope that's used in the African American tradition, isn't it? The idea of the Black Christ and identifying with Christ as an innocent sufferer, like the scapegoat in the society that's being passed out, right? I mean, you teach African American literature. Do you see that throughout, right?
Sure. And you know, I note in your chapter that you sent me that you you draw from County Colwin. Certainly mm-hmm. he brings it out in what he has to say. It also brings to my mind also Frederick Douglass mm-hmm. In his narrative, you know, here's Christ and here's Christians. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And these do not all come together. And Douglass makes this claim that Christ, the real Christ, is mm-hmm. as far from the white slave owner's Christ as possible to be.
Yeah.
In some ways, we may even have some of that same framing right here when Grant at the end rejects white spirituality, rejects a kind of a white faith. It doesn't seem to me like he's rejecting any possibility of a faith.
Mm-hmm.
But he says, you know, do I have my book handy? I don't know if I ought to be reading.
I've got mine.
reading on. It'll be around 251. Don't tell me to believe.
Mm-hmm.
Don't tell me to believe in the same God or laws that men believe in who commit these murders. Well, exactly, right? But the same God right there is not all God or every God.
Right.
It's this God. It's the God of whoever would approve this execution. So very much playing that through.
I was thinking when you're talking about Douglass, exactly right. When he in My Bondage and My Freedom, when he talks, is that where he talks about the blackbirds flying up? And he says, I knew two things in that instance when I saw the blackbirds singing freely.
Mm-hmm.
Right, that God was good and that slavery was a crime, right? Mm-hmm. It's this instant register of the difference between the white Christian God that was being propagated to him versus the one he was finding in natural law, in revelation, and also through the guidance of spiritual mentors, right, within the Black mm-hmm. Church. And mm-hmm. I love that parallel. I also, have you read, I know you probably have, you've read Jesus and the Disinherited, Howard Thurman. I love Thurman. Mm-hmm.
Well, you know what? That's on my Kindle.
He begins with saying, okay, let's look at Jesus for a second, because the Jesus that is sometimes preached or that I've heard preached is not the Jesus that we see in the Gospels. And so he really talks about a Jesus with his back against the wall is how he keeps talking about Jesus. And that mm-hmm. image of Jesus with his back against the wall is so much in A Lesson Before Dying. I mean, that's what Jefferson's back is against the wall, the entire narrative.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Mm-hmm. It's just this identity between the way that Thurman describes Jesus and the way that Gaines describes Jefferson that just really has stuck with me image wise.
You know, another thing that interests me that I think kind of enters into this moment here, frequently in this novel, the white supremacist way of thinking mm-hmm. is sort of represented. I'm not trying to over-Christianize the novel, but it almost looks a little bit secular, like there's a secular focus to the white supremacy. Mm-hmm. The elements of the white supremacist thought of that opening chapter is very much a kind of a social Darwinism. You know, he uses the word species. He uses animal, you know, the deepest jungle, the darkest, I don't remember the exact quote, but this phrase in there about the deepest, darkest Africa. Yeah. You got this notion that the shape of his head, he uses even some of that. All right. All of that nonsense that used to occur around the 20s is kind of a scientific sort of version of racism. And that almost undergirds, like when there's a scene a little bit later than that, where the school superintendent shows up at the school where Grant teaches, and all of his interaction looks like he's examining horses rather than people.
Yeah.
All right. And I mean, almost explicitly so. So there's a kind of I'm not trying to overstate religion or whatever, but there's a really interesting sort of contrast between the religious faith, not just of Reverend Ambrose or potentially of Jefferson, or but the godmother, Miss Emma, Tante Lou, the termination songs, the church services, even Vivian, who was very committed to a different faith, Christian faith still, but different from Miss Emma. And all of that in contrast to sort of this kind of deeply, as if it were an objective thing, secular kind of racism there.
Yeah, well, and what's interesting is this idea of the contrast between the forces, so social Darwinism or white supremacy, or this is the way that things are, versus the agency that's being granted, you know, through Grant, know, in this novel with Jefferson, that, you know, even when he talks about that example of who's the neighbor who carves wood, driftwood into
Mr. Farrell.
Mr. Farrell, right? It's the idea of this agency of being made into something else, that you don't have to be just the driftwood. You don't have to be classified that way, or you know, as though your fate is determined out, you know, because of your race, or your fate is determined because of society's claims on you. Instead, there's this agency. And maybe that's a lot of what Lesson Before Dying is moving us to, is that even though death is inevitable, there is the agency towards, you know, until your death, there is that will and that freedom that's there.
And again, Grant needs to learn all of that too. He has to teach it, and he has to learn it too. It's sort of like a professor knowing he's going to teach a novel in 3 weeks and needs to read it in the next two.
You have to be one step ahead of your students in order to be able to teach anybody. Well, and I would say even at the end, you know, ultimately what matters is whether we got the lesson before dying after the novel closes, because Grant and Jefferson are fictional. And we're not.
You know, there's actually I reviewed Gaines's essay on writing the novel.
Yeah.
And he concludes his essay. I hope you don't mind my reading.
No, please close with Gaines's words. That's the best place to start.
Well, we can go on as long as you like, but this is how he closes this essay. Gaines says, "I try to create characters with character to help develop my own character and maybe the character of the reader who might read me."
That is
so
beautiful.
You know, I think a large part of this novel is, in some ways, this novel strikes me as sort of more than most, really kind of demanding something of the reader. You know, I don't know. This may be just me, but I don't know if I could be doing the same things I was doing before as I would do afterwards. It seems like there's an expectation. It seems like there's some sort of call upon our lives to some degree on the basis of this novel. I think there are lots of good works of literature that will change our ways of thinking, will help us to sort of advance in what our lives are. But to some degree, this novel, I think it's very direct in saying, will we see people we may not have seen before in a different light? Will we truly say that there is a value to that life? Mm-hmm. And if there is, then what we're going to do about it, you know? Yeah. You know, what, it could be a variety of things, mm-hmm. you know? Oddly enough, one of the actions for, as we're introducing this novel to mm-hmm. people, one of the actions that's portrayed as heroic in this novel is eating a bowl of soup.
Yeah.
There's a moment in there where that is the thing identified as a heroic act. But it's a heroic act because it's an act of gratitude and love. Mm-hmm. And just the simplest possibilities for can we start to do some things right? This novel seems to me very much a novel with the potential, at least, to say, okay, there are some demands upon us, and we need to sort of figure out what those are. And I think Gaines is on that conclusion that I read there.
I think so too. And I think you said it incredibly well. I think that I probably should have talked to you even before I wrote this chapter because I feel like I've learned a lot about the novel, but there's always time to write more books and write again on this book at some point. Mm-hmm. So thank you for taking the time to be with us today. I really appreciate it.
No problem. No problem.
This episode was brought to you in part by the Table Podcast at Dallas Theological Seminary. Listen to rotating hosts discuss issues of God and culture to demonstrate theology's relevance in everyday life. Find it on your podcast app. For videos and more, visit dts.edu/podcast.